have a big hearing today on Senate Bill 642 with a lot of witnesses signed up. So, as always, I would encourage you to keep your comments as brief as you can, and so that we can get everybody in. So with that, I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 642. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. Senate Bill 642 relates to certain drug-free zones. Portland City Code Chapter 14B.20 and 14B.30, respectively, create and define drug-free zones and prostitution-free zones. Generally, these zones are specific areas that Portland has identified as having a high incidence of drugs or prostitution. The creation of such zones allows officers to exclude persons arrested for drug or prostitution offenses from the zone for a specified time period, 90 days after an arrest, then 1 year after any conviction, unless the person has a variance allowing the person to be in the zone for some sort of legitimate reason, work, education, social services, etc. A person who re-enters a park or public right-of-way within a drug or prostitution-free zone during a time the person has been properly excluded from that zone is subject to arrest, not more than 30 days in jail, and a maximum fine of $500. There are presently three drug-free zones, which generally can be divided as in Portland, downtown, along 82nd Avenue and some parts of North Portland. There are presently also two prostitution-free zones, which are also downtown and then along 82nd Avenue. Senate Bill 642 modifies a city's ability to exclude persons from drug-free zones, not prostitution-free zones, in the following primary way. An exclusion may only be based on a conviction and not merely on an arrest.
Okay.
Can I ask a question, Madam Chair of Council, before we get started?
Sure, Senator Walker.
This bill doesn't say it pertains to the city of Portland. It says any political subdivision. But is Portland the only city that currently practices this?
Senator Walker, to my knowledge, yes. Somebody that was speaking could correct me if I'm wrong. Eugene?
Holy cow, my city does this? All righty.
So far they do,
I'll
Senator Walker.
Attention.
I stand corrected.
Okay, enough comments from the peanut gallery here. Okay, we'll start out with Representative Shields, Senator Gordley, Roy Jay, and Willie Mayhart. Do you want everybody up at once, Chip? Or
Senator Gordley could not make it. She asked me to make some comments for her. But yes, Roy Jay and Ms. Hart.
And Willie Hart. Willie Mayhart, you here? There you go. Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Chip Shields, State Representative from District 43, Northeast Portland, testifying on behalf of myself as well as Senator Carter, who unfortunately is out of the state for a funeral, and Senator Gordley and other co-sponsors of the bill, Representative Greenlick, Representative Kotek, and Representative Holby, almost all of whom are either representing the zones in their House districts or are in close proximity. Over the course of the next half hour, hopefully not the next hour, I suspect you'll be confused. And as a fellow legislator, I know that it's easier to kill a bill than it is to pass it. Astute lobbyists will raise just enough confusion, just enough questions about a bill that legislators are uncomfortable moving it forward, and the bill dies. Now, I know you'll be tempted to set it aside because the more questions you ask, the more confusing this will become. But that's exactly why you should pass it. Because the confusion is why the bill must be passed. Because if you're having a hard time understanding the exclusion zones and how they operate, imagine how confusing they may be to the people excluded. Like the ones that Reverend Renee Ward will read about shortly on behalf of Sister Kathy Bowerman, the Executive Director of Rose Haven, a domestic violence shelter for women in downtown Portland. In her testimony, she wrote that shortly after the storms and flooding in New Orleans, a New Orleans woman came to our center and said she had been waiting outside a building where her husband had gone in to make a phone call. An officer came up to her and said she couldn't stay there. He said he'd give her an exclusion. She asked him what that was and what it was for. She told him she was from New Orleans. He gruffly asked her name, says, this is Sister Kathy Bowerman's words, not mine, and went to look up her criminal history. He came back saying, yes, she is from New Orleans, and she still had to get out of the area. That's why we need due process on the front end, because in this country, Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's simple. You're innocent until proven guilty. And I firmly believe that most of the time the police get it right. But sometimes they don't, and that's why you need due process on the front end. How is it, you should ask yourself, how is it that you can exclude someone without convicting them in a court of law first? And the more confused you get, keep asking, if the charges are dropped on a case, shouldn't the exclusion be dropped? And at the end of the day, I'll be confident you'll want to clarify, cut through by making the exclusion zones conviction-based. Because I truly believe that most of the time, the police do get it right. But not all the time, and that's why we need due process. I think that's essentially what this bill comes down to. This bill only deals with drug offenses, and all it says is that if you're going to exclude somebody from an area, that you convict them first. And that's the question that, in my view, you should keep coming back to. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for coming, and thank you for bringing this bill. Mr. Jay.
Madam Chair, committee members, good afternoon. I just want to somewhat echo what Commissioner Shields has basically said. And for the record, the police do get it right most of the time. They really do get it right. The conviction of, I'm particularly concerned about the folks from my community, African Americans, because those are the ones that are more higher in proportion that are going to be affected by this particular piece of legislation. From the African American Chamber of Commerce standpoint, everybody wants a safe community. I don't care if it's downtown. I've got business downtown. I've got business in Northeast Portland. I've got business everywhere. And everybody wants a safe community. We don't need drug dealers. We don't need prostitutes. We don't need, riffraff coming here and there, because it just tears away from the fabric of our community. I do believe, though, on behalf of the groups that we've been working with, is that some of this needs to be conviction-based. Now, that's not to say that there's got to be some type of middle ground, and I haven't had a chance to talk with Commissioner Shields in great detail, but I have talked to other folks as well. Habitual criminals, people that are constantly there doing drugs, need to go. But to just do a wholesale, you're not guilty. You're not going to be convicted of anything. We're just going to cite you. Thing. I know that this has become a problem because I run a volunteer project called Project Clean Slate, and a lot of these individuals have these little marks on their record that have not been excluded. So maybe there's a halfway mark that can be met if people are not convicted, that this stuff can also be erased or removed from their record so they can get on with their lives, because some people now realize the importance of staying away from these particular areas. So I'm not going to take up a lot of time, but I thought it was important for me to drive down here and at least give you my 3.5 cents worth. And if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer some later on, but I'm sure you got a lot of other folks that are sitting behind me that are waiting for the opportunity to tell you their side of the story. And for the most part, I think that we're headed down the right track of trying to make sure that everybody gets due process instead of just being out there hanging on a limb forever. Thank you for your time.
And thank you for coming.
Okay.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me here.
Can you get a little bit closer to the microphone?
Me.
Thank you.
Let's see if I can get closer. Okay, can you hear me?
We can.
Okay. To Senator Burdick and the Judiciary Committee staff, I thank you for allowing me the time to say what I have to say about the people. I live in the hood, and of course, I am very happy to see the police coming around in the neighborhood.
Can you give your name for the record,
please?
Oh,
I am sorry. It's Willie Mae Hart. My name is Willie Mae Hart, and I have had run-ins with some people, and one time I gave them a history lesson about 5 people, and they left the area. However, that doesn't work all the time, but people who have been incarcerated and try to change. Well, we should help them change. I've worked with the committee of Coffee Creek. I've been on that committee from day one. And some of them have gone back, and some of them have straightened up. But we shouldn't move them out of an area just because they have a record. If they have done the time, okay, we go along. If they want to be along with the rest of the group, fine. And we all should have legal protection as part of the view of justice. And our officials should be fair with everyone. If they have done the time, they should be allowed back. If they mess up again, okay, throw them out. That's the way I feel about it. But we should give them a chance to move on. The rights of freedom is not just for us, but for all people, and we should be compassionate, be fair and impartial. All should be given a second chance. The good news is, if deliverance abides, then I will say liberty and justice is for all. Thank you.
Thank you. I think if we could find out a little bit more about your history lesson, I think that might have application here in the legislature, Ms. Hart.
I have a history. Okay. You don't want to hear it. It'll take too much time.
Okay. Thank
well,
you.
Well, I have worked in many, with different organizations, and I have had some things thrown at me by my people, and I forgive them if they have paid the price for it and go on. I was told by a slave, my great-grandmother, never hate. So we cannot go on hating one another or pushing them in the corner because they've done wrong. Because if I tell you the entire history, several people that we have worked with through this WICS program have gone on and made better citizens and out of trouble. So we should be thankful. They have their children. And the judge didn't even know that this program existed. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for coming. Questions, Senator Walker?
Yes.
I have questions of Representative Shields. Thank you, Madam Chair. When you were talking about the woman from New Orleans, it brought me right back to reading Nelson Mandela's book, A Long Walk to Freedom. It took me 3 years to read that book because it's a long book, and I really wanted to understand it, but I thought, we don't live in South Africa where they made you have passes going from one community to the other. And that's what I felt like you were talking about there. But let me ask you this question. I know what this bill's about. You don't want to exclude someone if they just have an arrest record. But I'm reading the backside of the bill, page 2, on line 7 through 9. First you read line 4, and it says nothing in subsection 1 or 2 of this section is intended to prohibit, and you go to line 7, the exclusion of a person from public transportation, vehicles, or facilities for a reasonable time following the person's arrest for a criminal offense. Arrest, Representative Shields. Not a conviction. What's going on here?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Walker. I believe that later on, and there'll be some testimony from Chris O'Connor, an attorney who could talk about the nuance of the bill. But I think what that issue is getting to is that this exclusion zones are for public right-of-ways. So if you're on the street, on a public sidewalk, if you're walking on a street corner, if you're in the public domain, that's what this bill addresses. So if an officer is going to exclude you, they hand you an exclusion, you can't come back. You can still be in your house. You just, well, might not be able to leave your house. Or you could be in your car moving through. And now, of course, in fairness, they'll tell you there's a variety of ways that you can get around, living in the exclusion zone, and there are. But in my view, what it does is it turns innocent until proven guilty kind of on its head.
Well, okay. So, Madam Chair, can I follow up? Are you saying that a public transportation vehicle or facility doesn't qualify in this instance? I mean, I'm confused because you're allowing someone to be excluded if they've had an arrest, not a conviction, just an arrest. And I have a bill here this session that says you can't do that sort of thing because an arrest, you're innocent until you're proven guilty in this country the last time I looked. So I still am confused, which you've guaranteed me I would be with this bill today, right?
That's exactly why you should pass
all
it.
All right. I'll be confused until another witness comes.
The attorney should be able to answer your question.
Okay.
We'll take him first on the next proponent's
thank
panel,
you.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for bringing this forward.
Senator Beyer, wait. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Shields, just I guess a question. Why you did not include the prostitution-free zones also in this bill?
I think it was just a question of taking steps in whether or not we can have some advances. I think that there are concerns also around prostitution zones, but I frankly, Senator Beyer, didn't want to engage an army of thousands. I'd prefer an army of hundreds being opposed to this bill.
You can understand that, Senator.
Well, I guess, you know, for me, if it makes sense for one, it makes sense for the other. I mean, you know, if it takes a conviction to do one thing, shouldn't it take a conviction to do the exact same process in another area?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, your point's well taken. I think that that what we might do is perhaps pass this baby step and then analyze what the effect is. You know, have drug problems gotten worse in those exclusion zones or not? I would venture to say there won't be a whole lot of difference.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Now we'll take Chief Sizer and Jeff Myers from the Portland Police Bureau and James Hayden from the Multnomah County DA.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and committee members. My name is Rosie Sizer, and I'm the Portland Police Chief, and I'm here testifying on behalf of the Portland Police Bureau. I'm speaking in opposition to Senate Bill 642. I'm opposed to the bill for a number of reasons. Chief among those reasons is the breadth of the bill and the likely negative impact on community livability in the city of Portland. The bill would negatively impact our ability to deal with complaints of low-level disorder in public spaces, complaints like street drinking, drug dealing, and a variety of antisocial behaviors in public parks to include drinking, camping, fighting, drug use, and drug sales. I've been a Portland police officer for 22 years. I have served as a street officer and a lieutenant in North and Northeast Portland and a precinct commander in West and Southeast Portland. Complaints of street disorder are common in all areas of the city and gravely erode citizens' sense of safety and confidence in public institutions. I would like to particularly address the drug-free zone, which seems to be the particular focus of the bill. The drug-free zone was born of community policing efforts in the early 1990s. The areas of the city first covered were Old Town and Washington Park, both of which were beset by problems of open-air drug marketing. In the mid-1990s, a zone was created in North and Northeast Portland in response to community demand, particularly by the African-American community. The drug-free zone was a response to a broken jail system that resulted in either the immediate release of drug offenders or, on occasion, drug offenders were not bookable into the jails at all. The drug-free zone has been the subject of vigorous debate within the city of Portland, within the community, and in city council. It has met a variety of legal challenges and has been modified over time to provide greater and greater due process guarantees. For example, variances for residency, social service, employment are automatically provided to someone excluded from a zone. And exclusions are now vetted through a code hearings officer, an attorney, to ensure that they meet the standard of probable cause before the exclusion goes into effect. I realize drug-free zones are tough stuff. They're tough stuff because of the concern of civil liberties. It places some restrictions on people arrested for drug offenses in neighborhoods that are highly impacted by drugs and often by violence associated by the drug trade. Probably the most vulnerable people in our society when it comes to violence is the street corner drug dealer, who is readily identifiable, easily found, and involved in a very dangerous game, and are highly victimized. It is also tough stuff because of the issue of race. Minorities are overrepresented in both drug arrests and in exclusions. Probably because of lack of other opportunities in our society and the privileges that we as middle-class Caucasians hold, minorities are overrepresented in the population of drug dealers. One of the most hopeful efforts in recent years has been the collaboration between criminal justice agencies and social service providers to get frequent flyers in the criminal justice system into housing, into supportive service, and into drug treatment, and to stop them from churning in the criminal justice system. As you can probably tell, the drug-free zone is also complicated stuff, but essentially it is a local solution to a local problem. It is has been argued vigorously in courts. It is argued vigorously politically at city council every time the drug-free zone has come up for renewal. And it is the subject of an oversight committee that was placed into the effect recently because of the efforts of the mayor and city council. So I thank you for your time and attention to this complicated matter.
Thank you.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Jeff Myers. I'm a police officer for the city of Portland, assigned to the neighborhood response team. And I actually have a handout for you, if I may.
Perfect. Please give it to our assistant. Thank you.
Back in the summer, Madam Chair and members of the committee, back in the summer of 2003, the Police Bureau began a very ambitious pilot program designed to reduce recidivism rates among the most chronic offenders in the drug and drug-related property crime categories throughout the five downtown neighborhoods. What we did first is we actually did data runs to identify the most chronic offenders, and we were able to show with five downtown neighborhoods, three-month periods, in seven crime categories to encompass drug and drug-related property crimes. Those crime categories were identity thefts, unlawful use of motor vehicle, auto thefts, drugs, larceny car prowls, larceny shoplifting, and drug-free zone violations. When we initially did our data runs, we found that the number one offender had 47 arrests within a three-month period, and for most of those never went to jail. He just received a number of citations. The premise of the pilot program was that short periods of detention, 1 to 3 days, tied with social services to deal with the drug and alcohol dependencies and community court sanctions would reduce these recidivism rates. As you see the graph before you, when we began, we initially went to community court as our social service providers. We established a protocol with the jail where we actually, our top 35 offenders, we were able to book instead of giving citations. Before we began the program, we had an outside advisory group look at our methodology to ensure that there was no unintended racial profiling, and then we began through community court. We knew because of the lack of funding that community court was dealing with that we would not get satisfaction in terms of the social service aspect. As you see that first three dots on the line, our recidivism rates, our total numbers of offenders in each data run every 3 months grew. And then we went and actually started working with a social service provider, the director of mental health at the county, and he provided services in terms of drug treatment. And as you see, immediately between the two red lines, we had about a 33% reduction in recidivism rates amongst those offenders. He was ultimately fired, and as you see, after the red line, we went up to all-time highs. The data runs of 35 people encompassed 440 arrests for those 35 people in a three-month period for drug and drug-related property crimes. The city hired someone through Office of Neighborhood Involvement to work with me in terms of these ad hoc relationships we'd made with the Director of Mental Health, and we were again able to, for providing social services for these drug and drug-related property crime offenders, to reduce the recidivism rates again by 35%, approximately 35%. Then the city saw the merits of this in 2005 and began funding the drug treatment and housing. And as you see, recidivism rates at the second gold line immediately dropped, and they went down and have maintained for the last year a 71% reduction in recidivism rates amongst those offenders. What happens is the total group, anyone that's ever been on these lists, and that totals about 300 now, are provided immediate anytime they're arrested for drug and drug-related property crimes, drug-free zone violations. They're immediately afforded housing and drug treatment, either inpatient or outpatient. And as I said, our numbers have gone from the cumulative totals of each list being 440 down to a mere 127, which is about a 71% reduction in recidivism rates. The drug-free zone plays a big part in this actual program. Because of its success, we're looking at expanding it into the other drug-free zone in Northeast Portland. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair or members of the committee.
Before we move on, how does the drug-free zone drug exclusion zone fit into this treatment program? I mean, this treatment program sounds wonderful, but how does the exclusion zone fit in there?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I have another handout for you in anticipation of that question. When I did the data runs initially, my hypothesis was that seven crime categories that I mentioned to you would encompass the drug and drug-related property crimes. The unfortunate part of using those crime categories are the very low instances of arrests. In fact, you'll see over the last 5 years, Portland experiences anywhere from 75 to 100 car prowls a day per year. And out of that, we only have a 1%, less than 1% arrest rate. So if you're doing data runs and trying to encompass the actual crimes, when we have a less than 1% arrest rate on many of these drug and drug-related property crimes, it was impossible just on those bases to identify that group of chronic offenders, the 35 every 3 months. Actually including, we've done it with drug-free zone violations and without the drug-free zone violations. Without the drug-free zone violations, we're not able to distinguish between the real chronic offenders. When we incorporate the drug-free zone violations, then the cream rises to the top, and we're able to identify the most needy and the most chronic offenders, apply our resources towards them, and then we see a huge decrease in those recidivism rates. And for instance, Old Town was one of the neighborhoods, was the epicenter of this drug and drug-related property crime in downtown Portland. And they, over the last decade, have had the most vociferous neighborhood livability committee. And in fact, as a consequence of this work, they've disbanded, and we hear very little concern from that community as compared to what it was in the past. And it's really these offenders that we've been able to identify. We've been able to apply resources. It's very humane. It's very cost-effective, much less expensive than jail, and it's very successful.
Well, the program sounds great. The question I have is this the only way to get there? For example, would you have any other way of recording these people? I mean, I assume there are barriers to arrest, probably having to do with resources and enough officers, et cetera. I mean,
Madam Chair and members of the committee, it's actually more than that. If you look at these other offenses, auto thefts, car prowls. They're crimes of opportunity, and police, even with more resources, it's very difficult to solve those types of crimes. Often a car prowl, 100 a day in the city of Portland, somebody's walking by, window shopping, looks in less than 5 seconds they break into the car, take items to $500 to $1,000 damage to the car. But what we are very good at is once we've identified someone that's that has drug issues and they've been excluded from that zone, it's very easy for a police officer to identify that person and then go and make contact and apply resources for them. It would be very difficult to identify them based upon the criminal activity.
Okay, other questions before we move on, since I broke in before the panel was done? Okay, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Jim Hayden. I'm the neighborhood DA for North and Northeast Portland. I've been a DA about 20 years, and I've been the neighborhood DA for 12 years. And I was the neighborhood. Better. I was the neighborhood DA that began our first community court, and was in that court for 5 years in Northeast Portland. And was a neighborhood DA who worked with the African American community to institute the first drug-free zone in Northeast Portland. And I've been the DA that has been in court on, I want to say, almost probably 100% of every drug-free zone challenge that has been brought by the defense bar in the last 15 years. So I'm quite familiar with it, and I almost feel like it's difficult for me to boil down succinctly why this bill is not good for Portland. Let me try to give you three general areas, though. First area is that the drug-free zone ordinance, if you read it today, is constitutional. Again, it's been challenged numerous times. I have always been the DA defending the drug-free zone ordinance, and almost every of the last several times it has been in front of Judge Michael Marcus, a very civil liberties-minded judge and also one of our brightest judges. It is true that he has found flaws in it, but they have never been flaws of the variety of constitutional infirmities that people want to say that there are. Again, due process for the ordinance is constitutional. It provides equal protection and adequate procedural due process as well. And I don't go into all the reasons, but for many reasons, the ordinance is constitutional. Any problem the court has found with it, and I'm thinking particularly of Judge Marcus, has been amended by the Portland City Council in the next session. So the fact that it's constitutional leads me into my second area, which is that it's handled responsibly. Not only do we have an oversight committee in place now, Portland City Council has responded and amended this ordinance to bring it in line with any criticisms by the Multnomah County Circuit Court every time those criticisms have been made. So it's constitutional as we sit here today. It is being responsibly handled by the Portland City Council. Finally, what I want to bring to your attention is that, and this is jumping off where Officer Myers left off, and that is this ordinance helps people get into drug treatment. This helps people be identified, and it helps them get into court more and more frequently than if they weren't excluded from the drug-free zones. And it also has unintended consequences for those very reasons. In Portland, we have not only the community court that attempts to engage people in drug treatment. So all the misdemeanor drug offenses are routed into community court. And by and large, all of these, hundreds of these, are from the drug-free zones. At the same time, you have the Stop Drug Treatment Court. We're now talking not hundreds, but probably 1,000 or more cases a year that go into the Stop Drug Treatment Court. Both of these courts operate, and both of these courts, most of their clientele, the vast majority of their clientele, are drug-free zone offenders. Both of these courts operate on the premise of, if you do as the court asks, in return, your case will be dismissed. Imagine what will happen if this bill passes, and what you're saying to the city of Portland is you can only exclude someone from a drug-free zone if they are convicted, and the Stop Drug Treatment Court and the community court dismiss their cases. What it will equal is no exclusions for easily more than 1,000 people every year that will be going back into those communities. And that poses a real dilemma for the district attorney, because he has a community that he feels strongly to protect, as does the chief of police. And the best tool to do that right now, with absolutely no jail space to do it, is through exclusion through the drug-free zone. So he's forced into a dilemma of, do I choose drug-free zone exclusion, or do I choose treatment? And it's certainly something that the district attorney will have to revisit. And if the choice is, I'm going to force people from now on to obtain convictions from Stop Drug Treatment Court, and I'm going to force convictions from community court, what will happen is many of those people will not choose to partake of Stop Drug Treatment Court or community court. They will opt for trial, because they know the consequences at trial are very limited. There's no jail space, and so there's nothing really to lose. Indigent defense costs, I fear, will rise dramatically. Valuable court time will be used up. Those are unintended consequences of this. We've set up a process that works very well. It's treatment-minded. It's safe for the community. And I'm afraid if this bill passes, whether out of this committee or in the legislature, it will have very unfortunate and unintended consequences for the city of Portland. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Oh, excuse me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, we'll take Commissioner Jeff Cogan and Chris O'Connor. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Cogan. I am a recently elected Multnomah County Commissioner, and I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 642. I want to say right from the get-go, the Multnomah County Commission has not taken that position. They're neutral on this bill. I'm here personally advocating on behalf of my own beliefs. But my beliefs are formed not only on the basis of my relatively brief tenure of working at the Multnomah County Commission. Prior to this job, I worked for 5 years in the city of Portland as most recently chief of staff for City Commissioner Dan Saltzman. Before that, I ran a small business in downtown Portland. And before that, I practiced law. In all of these endeavors, collectively, they led me to believe that the current exclusion zones are extremely troubling. They're a very arcane method of trying to get around the constitutional question, which is at its very core for our country, that people don't suffer severe penalties without being convicted of something. The current standard that an arrest allows someone to be excluded from a part of town, while well-meaning and certainly useful for law enforcement, it's very convenient, there's no doubt about that, is really troubling to me constitutionally and just as a matter of fairness in our community. The district that I represent is all of North and most of Northeast Portland. Within my district are boundaries for two exclusion zones, the Northeast one and 82nd Avenue. And the recent evidence that's come forward about the very disproportionate impact of the exclusion zone, particularly on African Americans, is very troubling for me. It's very troubling for my constituents. And I think that it's one of the big problems with the current standards is that there really aren't standards. By virtue of allowing someone to be excluded just based on arrest, it puts, in my opinion, too much power in the individual discretion of an officer without any uniform standards that you would have by virtue of having someone be convicted first. I think it's very appropriate for the state to act in this matter. The state has acted in other areas such as asset forfeiture or driver's licenses for driving under the influence that are civil penalties, and I think it is appropriate, but also would set a uniform standard for all Oregonians in terms of where they would be subject to this, frankly, very significant penalty. I also think that having worked at the city for 5 years, that the current system, although favored by the police, is actually fairly divisive and troubling for the city. Every time the exclusion zones come up again to be renewed, there's a tremendous battle which takes an awful lot of time and energy. They also put the city at risk for legal action, and there have been a whole series of legal actions, so it's my opinion that it doesn't serve the city very well. It also has potential implications for Multnomah County. I know you are aware of the fact that we have a jail bed shortage. It's also the case that a very high percentage of the people who are what we call the frequent flyers, the folks who are in jail all the time, are arrested for some version of criminal trespass, and that is the standard for violating an exclusion zone. And I believe that a lot of the folks who wind up getting jailed for this have not been convicted of the underlying crime, but are instead being convicted of violating the exclusion as opposed to any underlying crime in the first place. So to me, it's a matter of fairness, and it's a matter of equitable policy. I also say that this is a time in our nation when fundamental civil liberties are under assault in a way that hasn't happened, at least in my lifetime, before. And I would feel really great if Oregon was, rather than coming up with novel ways to undermine civil liberties, taking a really strong stand to defend them. And I urge you to do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Before we move on, how do you respond to the argument that these have been an effective way of basically channeling people into drug treatment and keeping them out of the criminal justice system?
Well, to the extent that they're used in that way, I think that they can continue to be used in that way, just having a different standard. We're not here talking about getting rid of exclusion zones. We're talking about having standards for exclusion zones, that people can only be excluded once they've been convicted of something. It may well be that there are certain people who do not get excluded because the standard is now just arrest, and who would be under the conviction. There may be some delta there. I'm sure there is. But it's important to remember, we're not saying to get rid of them. I certainly think that the notion of encouraging people into treatment is something we should consider, but I don't think that that's, I think to a certain extent that's a red herring argument, because you don't have to end your efforts to get people into treatment because you're setting up standards for exclusion zone that require someone to be convicted first.
Okay. Senator Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Kogan. Commissioner Kogan, you worked for Commissioner Dan Salzman for 5 years, so you've seen this come up. How often does this exclusion zone get renewed?
It's every year or two. They've done it for different periods of time, but regularly.
So you've been through it before?
Yes.
You're a lawyer?
Yes.
Recovering lawyer?
Indeed.
Okay. And there was argument by one of the witnesses, Jim Hayden, a moment ago, who said that Judge Marcus has seen these cases in court many times and found them to be constitutional. So can you reply to that,
please? Well, I think what's actually happened is that Judge Marcus has found problems that have then been corrected and then come back up. And it may well be that the current scheme meets Judge Marcus's notion of what's constitutional. That doesn't necessarily mean that it would be upheld by higher courts as constitutional. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it's the right thing to do either. I mean, I think that these exclusion zones have been designed to try and get around, in a kind of squirrely way, the fundamental notion that you don't have consequences without being convicted. Even if they have been designed, and I'm not convinced that a higher court would agree that they're constitutional, but even if they have been designed in such a way, it doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing for us to do.
Madam Chair, can I follow it up? It's unlikely that any of the people who've been excluded would challenge it to a higher court, because they generally don't have the kind of money, unless the ACLU or someone wants to take them on and take their case forward. But I have some concerns about this law. How did you shape your opinion about it working for your former boss? How did he support?
Well, first of all, I should say he and I disagree about this.
Okay.
So I want to be clear about that. He doesn't support my position on this.
He's still on the commission, is he not?
He is still on the commission.
Okay.
And I've shared my concerns with him, and he doesn't agree with me about this.
Okay. Well, this, as Representative Shields said, I'm just going to be more confused as we move along. It's getting curiouser and curiouser. Fair Thank enough. You.
Thank you.
Thank you. Question, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I think it was the representative from the DA's office, I don't know if he actually said it, but he inferred it if he didn't say it, was that one of the problems they have is jail space, and if you don't have an exclusionary zone and you don't have anywhere to put people when they are, arrested for doing something, they're just back doing the same thing they were doing.
Yeah.
And you mentioned jail space also, the lack of jail space. So it seems like a possible solution to this is jail space. And you guys happen to have a jail up there that hasn't even opened yet. So I guess...
Can we talk about paying for that?
Yeah, I think you should talk about paying for that because it's a county jail and you are a county commissioner. And
indeed.
County commissioners get paid to open jails when
Fair
they're
point.
There.
And I do think, frankly, that the real issue is that we have inadequate jail space. And that you shouldn't justify a policy because the jail space isn't there. You create good laws, and then you figure out a way to open the jails that you need to have. And that's what I think we need to do.
Okay, so by that, if this bill were to pass, would you then support opening the jail so that the police would have some place to put the people?
I support it right now.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Beyer.
And you heard it all right here in the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Okay, moving right along. Now we have our lawyer here, Senator Walker, so we'll get your legal questions answered. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris O'Connor. I'm an attorney at Metropolitan Public Defender. I should state that I'm not representing Metropolitan Public Defender or its board here today. I've been practicing for 3 years doing indigent defense work, and I've represented dozens of people, if not more, in challenging the drug-free zone exclusions, challenging the criminal charges brought about by people being excluded and then returning to the zone. And I've worked with people in the community at neighborhood groups and spoken out against the drug-free zone at city hearings and city town halls. The real goal of the drug-free zone, I think, was summed up very well by Judge Marcus in his recent opinion. I was the attorney on that case opposite Deputy District Attorney Jim Hayden and the city attorney. In his opinion, which was issued in spring of 2005, Judge Marcus made various critiques of the ordinance. He ultimately upheld the general nature, the general notion of a drug-free zone, but there were specific unconstitutional parts and parts that needed to be changed. The city has made some of those. It has not since been re-reviewed by the judge. In his opinion, Judge Marcus wrote that, and I'll quote from his opinion, the ordinance amounts to an elaborate scheme to accomplish detention, arrest, exclusion, and search of its targets while avoiding judicial oversight and the inconvenience of older restrictions on search and seizure occasioned by exclusionary rules first fashioned to protect the liberties of its citizens. In enacting this ordinance, I think the police seek convenience over civil liberties. They're attempting to do their job, which is protect the community. I think it's an appropriate goal for a government, an admirable goal to stop crime. And enforce the state statutes that the legislature has passed, but they're attempting to go beyond the limits or right up to the limits of what they're allowed to do to search and seize people. It's also the most complicated ordinance probably in the state of Oregon in terms of criminal ordinances. It goes to 15 pages if you print it out, and it's almost no one's actually read the whole thing. I want to do a brief run through of what happens to a person and how they come to be represented by someone using money from the State Indigent Defense Fund. A person who is suspected of committing a drug offense is arrested by an officer. They may be walking down the street, they see somebody with a crack pipe. That person is then arrested and charged with possession of a controlled substance. Simultaneously, they're issued an exclusion. They're told you can't come back to the zone for 90 days. That 90 days starts once the city hearings officer has reviewed the case. The officer files that exclusion with the city. A city hearings officer reviews it. They throw out 8% of them for officer error or because there was no probable cause to arrest.
8%?
That's either a very good sign that our city hearings officers are doing a great job, or the opposing view would be that 8% are errors, and that's not acceptable. That person is then excluded for 90 days. If they're not excluded, they're not told. So a person might still think they're excluded. There's no mechanism to inform these people that they weren't excluded by the city hearings officer. Then that person goes about their business. Now, say they go to inside the zone. They may be walking to an AA meeting in a church basement. They may be walking down the bus mall in downtown Portland. If an officer sees them or comes into contact with them and knows they're excluded, they are arrested for two new offenses. They're arrested for violation of a drug-free zone and criminal trespass. at that point they enter the court system on this new case. So they have the previous possession case, and now they have a new drug-free zone violation and criminal trespass case. We're, in many cases, appointed to represent these defendants in the court for the criminal trespass and violation of a drug-free zone opinion, or of a drug-free zone exclusion. They then have to go to court on both of these cases. I support this bill because I think that the better mechanism is what we have, and what we've always had, is a system of pretrial supervision in which a person who's arrested is brought before a court. In the example I used, the person with the crack pipe would be brought to the court. They'd say, you're released. You should be supervised by our supervision officers until you can go to trial. If that person is convicted, they are then subject to probation, 18 months of probation on for a typical PCS case, and they would then be supervised by the parole and probation office. If they violate that, they go to jail. And it's already a restriction that they not associate with drug dealers and that they're allowed to have geographic restrictions. The state system is comprehensive. It covers all the different drug crimes. We have a probation system. We have a prison system. There's arguments over what the appropriate sentence is here in Salem. And we have a working system. The state system isn't good enough for the city, unfortunately, and they're trying to get around the state system to put additional penalties on to alleged offenders. And unfortunately, the results are there. Even if the case is dropped, in the case of my example, say the officer doesn't charge him with the possession of a controlled substance, or the DA drops the case, or the judge determines there was an illegal search or seizure in the circuit court case, the criminal case disappears, but that person's still subject to new criminal charges for violating the exclusion. I'd like to forward some statistics that were given to me. As a member of the so-called Oversight Committee, I don't believe that's an adequate response to this issue. It was not brought up until weeks ago when this issue became apparent. This was an issue that was going to be there's going to be a contentious issue again. I don't believe the committee actually has any ability to do any oversight. We'll see. We've had one meeting so far. These statistics, I think, are show one of the main problems with the drug-free zone exclusion. African Americans make up 50% of the drug arrests within the drug-free zone. And that's a number, we'll just take that as the basis here. So now that these people have been arrested, what happens to them? Well, of all the exclusions issued to people who are arrested for drugs, it's not automatic. It's discretionary to the officer if he wants to exclude. It's also some cases are thrown out by the city hearings officer. But it turns out that 64% of the people then excluded after these drug arrests in the zones are African American. It's 14% higher than the actual number of exclusions. Now, who gets arrested for violating these exclusion zones? 78% of the people arrested in drug-free zones for violating the zones are African American. If we add in Hispanic, Latino, Native American, and Asian, it turns out whites make up 41% of the drug arrests in the zone, but only 31% of the exclusions, and only 19% of the violations. The effect of this on the community is great. People feel like they're being picked on because of their racial groups. There's a concern among people. This is a police bureau statistics that were provided to the committee. It's concerning that only 58% of the white arrests in the drug-free zones resulted in exclusions, while 100% of the African-American arrests resulted in exclusion. It's this perceived confusion and aura of perceived discrimination that's another serious effect of this. I would also suggest to you that a reason for the state legislature to be involved in this and to be regulating these drug-free zones is to control the costs. Here the city has an unfunded mandate, essentially. They're issuing a law that is then the county's duty to jail offenders for. It's then the district attorney's office, not the city, that ends up spending the time prosecuting and defending these in court. in part. I know the city does is involved in much of the defense as well. And additionally, then the state pays because of the cost of the Indigent Defense Fund. Our office represents hundreds, if not thousands, of these over the past 10 years. And you don't get a say in that, unfortunately, as under the current system. It's money coming out of the Indigent Defense Fund. I think the stop court argument raised by stop court is a drug program in which a person enters a guilty plea and then is placed on a suspended sentence, essentially, until they go through a year of drug treatment. At the end, if they successfully complete their drug treatment, the case is dismissed. I don't think this would affect the drug court program. I don't think this would affect the community court program either. I believe those are red herrings, as was mentioned. The community court program does not always result in a dismissal, I should say. If you've been in the community court probably about most cases more than once, then your next case results in a conviction, although limited jail time and no probation, that's true. But not all community court results in a dismissal. The majority of it doesn't. It's a great opportunity for first-time offenders to earn a dismissal through community service or treatment, but our office does represents two of the four community courts, offenders in two of the four community courts, and it doesn't always result in a dismissal. I'm happy to answer any questions or explain it further. I would just say that I would encourage the committee and the chair to consider this, and it is complicated, but it's not impossible to understand, so I'm happy to help explain it.
Some questions? Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, could you provide the committee with a copy of Judge Marcus's opinion that you talked about from the spring of 2005?
I do not have a copy here. It's available on the website of the Multnomah County Circuit Court.
We'll have our counsel get it, Senator Walker.
Okay.
And I have, I think, one copy I can provide. It's available and widely used. Under the current, I talk to other attorneys doing misdemeanor cases in my office. I no longer do misdemeanor cases at this time. But what is happening is that when we do challenge it now, the district attorney dismisses the case rather than deal with the legal challenges. A person who repeatedly goes to court asking for a trial on the drug-free zone issue, they dismiss the drug-free zone charge. Of course, there's the criminal trespass charge associated that sometimes ends up getting tried. But the actual merits of the case haven't been litigated in quite a while.
Okay, I have just a couple more questions, Madam Chair. What if you live in the drug-free zone? What happens then?
I live on the edge of the drug-free zone. I haven't been excluded. But what happens is that you have an automatic variance to return to your house. You can go to and from your house. But if you were to stop on the corner and talk to a neighbor, that would be a violation of the law, and you'd be subject to arrest for trespass. If you we're going to or from your lawyer, a social service agency, those are automatic. You used to have to carry papers with you to show that you were, had permission. Thankfully, Judge Marcus eliminated that provision. You had to show papers to pass through the zone. That's changed. Of course, the confusion lingers. People are asking me, how do I get a variance? How do I show my social worker I'm allowed to go to my social worker's office, which is what happened at our clinic the other day. Someone came in saying, how do I get a variance? You don't need a variance to go to your social worker, thankfully. The problem is it's your burden to prove that you have permission or that you were going to those agencies or lawyer's office. So if you're walking out the lawyer's door, you could still be arrested for trespass, jailed, and then have to prove in court that you were at your lawyer's office that day or at your social worker.
Madam Chair, I just get more upset about this by the minute. I'm glad I don't live in the city of Portland.
You live in the city of Eugene.
And I understand we have one, and I'm going to be investigating it. The next thing I wanted to ask you is you indicate in your testimony, the person does not have the right to a lawyer to represent them during the exclusion process.
That is correct. In my example where a person was excluded for possessing a crack pipe on the street within the drug-free zone, a person would get a lawyer to represent them on that possession charge. So 30 days later when they're supposed to appear in community court, they would get an attorney, or if they appeared at the courthouse for arraignment, they would get an attorney appointed. But meanwhile, behind the scenes, there is an appeal process that they could be filing. There is a decision by the city attorney's office that you would have to appeal if you so wished. You do not get an attorney because it's not that exclusion. The city considers that a civil exclusion. And so you do not have the right to a appointed counsel on that case. And unfortunately, with resources limited as they are, there's by the time indigent defense counsel is appointed, it's either in place or it's not. So the appeal process is often passed by the time it comes to the attention of someone's appointed attorney on another case, and even then it would just be a courtesy to go and represent them on that. That's happened in the past as well, where individual attorneys have represented people on appeal. But you have no attorney on this.
Yeah, that's against the Constitution, in my opinion. Madam Chair, I have one more question, if I might.
One quick one.
Could you address the second page of the bill? It gets confusing saying what section, but it's on lines 7 through 9. And it starts out on line 4 on page 2. The question I asked Representative Shields about you're intending to prohibit exclusion based on arrest, yet it appears on lines 7 through 9 that that's what you're allowing to have happen in this bill.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the issue here is I support Representative Shields' bill, and I think it's a valuable step. I personally would prefer to see there be no exclusions based on arrest. The reason I believe that this is a necessary part of this bill is that given the current, there's currently a large number of cases in the city of Portland and Multnomah County regarding exclusions from TriMet vehicles where there's an incident on a bus or an arrest made on a bus. I think that you probably have less rights to access a vehicle owned by a city or municipality or county or transportation agency than you would just to walk down the sidewalk. I think the first step is to make sure that people can walk down the sidewalk, just like a person doesn't necessarily have the right to enter a city police office at any time of day whenever they want, or a TriMet bus whenever they want. There's fees, fares. I think that's where that comes from. I would be happy to support a bill where you couldn't be excluded without conviction as well, but I think that this is a more realistic and gets to the more fundamental ability to walk down your own street.
Well, probably goes, Madam Chair, to Representative Shields' comment that you'd rather have hundreds of people in opposition than thousands, but for me it just seems consistent to make that.
Okay, we're going to move on to our next panel now. We're getting a little short of time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Russ Isham and Joe Schweinhart.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Joe has another hearing that he's attended to, so he's kind of left me on my own here. So,
well, why don't we bring up Richard Brown, who's also testified kind of between you guys. I couldn't tell whether he was with you or not. We'll bring him up, too. Okay, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Russ Isham. I'm a sergeant with the Salem Police Department, and I'm here representing Chief Jerry Moore and the Salem Police Department in opposition of Senate Bill 642. And I can agree with a lot of the comments that were made by the Portland police officers and understand the reasons why. And for the last 4 years, I've supervised either the crime prevention unit or a street crimes unit that deals with drugs and prostitution, as well as trying to establish long-term resolutions or solutions to neighborhood problems. So I've had an opportunity to work both sides of that, and working with the neighbors is kind of why I'm here today. In the past few years, we've done several prostitution stings in the city of Salem. And just to kind of back up a little bit, the city of Salem currently has one crime prevention district. We are 6 days away from going to a public hearing to establish our second crime prevention district in Salem. And that would cover the north end of town for prostitution and drug arrests. And working with the neighbors, one of the biggest concerns that the neighborhood has is that when we go out and do a prostitution sting or a drug sting in a neighborhood, we oftentimes see the same people returning to the area either the same day or shortly thereafter within the same time, short time period. So what we've tried to do is try to find other solutions to the problems that we're experiencing. From the police department's perspective, I'm sure like many of the police departments around, our resources aren't adequate enough for us to be able to conduct large sting operations on a regular basis. Also, some of the things that we've been experiencing is that within our municipal court and our district attorney, we have often seen some of these cases that aren't being tried because of resources. And so we're looking at trying to find other solutions to be able to keep people from bringing their criminal intentions, their actions, their associates back into the neighborhoods. And civil exclusions is one of those means that we have available to us. What we look at is making arrests, probable cause arrests for prostitution or drug arrests in the case of this bill, all of the drug arrests, and being able to issue those exclusions to keep people from returning. And what we have to be able to do is address those concerns from the neighbors. So I'm not going to go over, you understand all of the issues, I'm sure. I'm here to just to let you know that Salem Police Department opposes Senate Bill 642. We are looking forward to establishing a second crime prevention district. And our exclusions in the past, we've had 527 exclusions in our downtown area. And what we found is when we did the numbers, only 25% of those exclusions were for the most serious offenders. And those are the types of people that we're trying to keep out of the neighborhoods. And those are the ones that are creating or are using the drugs, that sort of thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the committee? Welcome, Mr. Brown.
Good afternoon. My name is Richard Brown. I'm a community activist in Portland, Oregon. And let me first say that I thought that there may have been a little post-hypnotic suggestion here when folks suggested that you all would be confused. This isn't a very confusing issue for me. I oppose the bill. For 15 years, I facilitated a community meeting weekly. In those 15 years, we probably missed a dozen meetings. For 16 months, we performed a foot patrol in one of the worst areas of Northeast Portland that now has a drug-free zone. 16 months, 5 hours a night, 7 days a week. Probably missed a handful of nights that we didn't do it. If I had a magic wand, I'd dump all these dope sellers and dope addicts in the neighborhoods of folks who supported this measure. And then when it got out of hand for you, you would figure out on your own how to get rid of them. Nobody was around when people were coming to our meetings. The first meeting we had was 400 people there. We had people from the agencies in Portland County and city agencies. So we could tell them what our concerns in the community was. Among them was drug selling and associated crime and disorder. The drug-free zone came about because of those meetings. We were angry because they took it to Washington Park and downtown and didn't do it in the community. It was so bad in Portland, Mike Shrunk, driving down Alberta Street, was stopped to find out if he wanted to buy drugs. It was rampant. Women could not walk the streets without being asked if they were looking for dates. No citizen should have to go through that. I remember a woman who slept in a bathtub because of the associated chaos that goes along with drug selling, drug dealing in our community. She thought a bathtub offered her protection from gunfire. People get shot in Northeast Portland. Most of it that happens on the street is around drugs. Most of it's around drugs and gangs. We don't need that in our community. The drug-free zone has been a very good tool to help curb that. It hasn't gotten rid of all of it. It's still there. But it's not as bad as it was. It's important that when you think about these folks who get who are stopped from walking through the community, that you understand that there are people in the community that don't want that stuff there. Do they come forward? Do they come to hearings like this? No, because they live in the community and they don't want anybody to know that they're not concerned about these things. When we did the foot patrol, we required 5 people to walk in 2.5-hour shifts. Most of the people who walked did not live in the community because the people were scared that if the folks who were involved in the crime saw them, there would be retaliation. We walked anyway. education was what happened. We finally got the folks that lived there not to come out and walk with us, not to be visible, but to call the police when they saw it. When they saw crime going on, they would call the police. It was real important that that happened, because when we left, to this day, crime has not reached the levels that it had before we started the foot patrol.
Mr. Brown, I'm going to have to cut you off now because we're running out of time. So do you have a concluding comment?
I don't support the bill.
Very clear. Thank you. All right. Okay. Now, by the way, audience, this has been a little longer than thought it might be, so we will not be getting to the other bills on our agenda today if we have people there for those bills. We probably won't make it through all the witnesses on this one either, so please keep your comments as brief as possible so we can have hopefully time for everybody. Okay, Reverend Renee Ward, Marcus Branch, and Pastor Woods.
Good afternoon. I'm actually sitting in on behalf of Sister Kathy Borman as a family member.
Can you identify yourself?
My name is Reverend Renee Ward, unofficial, but also the Chief of Staff for Representative Chip Shields, who has asked me to be in proxy for Sister Kathy Borman, who writes to you on this day. It states, greetings to each of you, and thank you for listening to my letter. I intended to be here in person, but one of my sisters had a stroke last night, and I need to stay nearby. I have worked with persons without a home for many years in Portland. I am a good shepherd sister and have found that the free zones have frequently been a cause or permission for injustice. I know this sounds harsh, but please hear me out.
Wait, before you proceed, how long is that? Because you can submit that to the record and summarize if it's long. If it's short, then
it is short. Actually, Representative Shields has referenced some of it earlier, so I am editing it because of the time.
Perfect. Thank you.
May I proceed?
Yes, please.
Most people, when they get confronted by the police, are frightened, alarmed, and do not hear any instructions they may be given regarding contesting or even how to get exclusions. They don't understand that they could contest this, even if they understand most of the people I know are afraid to go contest the exclusion, fearing that they will be put in jail, especially those who don't have a clue as to what they supposedly did wrong in the first place. I'm editing at this time, going down to a point of reference. Let me tell you about a few persons I know who were issued exclusions and what they were doing when they got them. One woman walking home from a grocery store with a bag of groceries in each hand and a dog on a leash was told she was soliciting and given an exclusion. Another woman was on her way to Rose Haven, a resource and community center for women and their kids. She had come from a domestic violence situation. She was given exclusion for she had no idea what reason. Lastly, early one morning, I was walking to work. I saw a young man about 18 looking frightened and asked if I could help him. He had just bussed in from Seattle and had a job interview. He had gone down to the MAX and was trying to figure out which train to take when he was given exclusion. Earlier, Representative Shields referenced an incident involving a woman who is now one of our new residents from New Orleans. The New Orleans woman came to our center and said she had been waiting outside a building where her husband had gone in to make a phone call. An officer had come up to her and said she couldn't stay there. He said he'd give her an exclusion. There are many men and women who have a history of drug use but have worked hard to get and stay clean. Often they are targeted also. They go to places like others to get ongoing support in believing in themselves and making good decisions. In closing, it is not at all uncommon for them to get slapped with an exclusion on their way to see us before going to work. As Melissa would put it, why should we try when we keep getting hit back down? Don't people understand that we can change? Please, please do not set up this extremely unjust system that promotes more injustice and targeting of the poor. This comes again from Sister Kathy Borman. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Mr. Branch.
Yes, good afternoon, Chair, Lady, and Committee. What I'd like to do is echo that I was one of those foot patrols that was out with Richard Brown also in the community. My name is Marcus Branch, and I have a business owner in Portland for the past 17 years. I have always have concerns for the safety of my neighbors and their well-being. However, with the possibility of the Senate Bill 642 being passed, I am even more concerned on how it will impact my community at large. Significantly, I am concerned about the language of the bill in which implies the police will have the right to exclude at will based upon their perception only, which historically has proven bias when addressing people of color. I have based this conclusion on the national statistics that I have read, as well as locally through the conversations that I have had with individuals who had interacted with the police officers. Normally, innocent until proven guilty has always been a mantra how we are to address questionable offenses. But if the Senate Bill 642 is passed, then we will then be faced with another dilemma. Standing while being black. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Pastor.
Yes, I'm Pastor Woods from Calvary Christian Church. I'm formerly a drug and alcohol counselor and also formerly the clinical coordinator for the Center for Community Mental Health. And I'm a real advocate for homeless and adolescents. Our church at the present house homeless during the week. We feed and we provide shelter and resources and referrals. I'm aware that there has been exclusion laws in the past, you know, since in Oregon since the 1840s, but also I'm aware that they've always had to come back and to be amended, and it didn't seem to work. I have some concerns that the officers will have the power to stop suspicious individuals. Many of them may be found with crack pipes, and many of these people are not dealers, but many of these people are drug addicts and people with mental illnesses, and a lot of that is dual diagnosis is hand in hand. The exclusions, I'm concerned if it's going to be illegally applied, properly enforced, and if it's fair. I also believe in the neighborhoods need to be safe. You know, I live in the neighborhood. I want it to be safe and desirable place to live. However, if the act or practice to exclude must be with fairness, and I'm concerned that that's not the case and that will not happen. I'm concerned that individuals that we serve, many of the referrals that we give are in Northeast, referrals for social services, referrals for education, employment, and many of these people reside in the area or have family that reside in the area. I don't see this as being an answer, but more of a problem instead of addressing the real issue, which is addictions and mental illnesses. Exclusions really aren't the answer to just the situation, but I believe it's just bias.
Thank you very much. Okay, in the interest of fairness, we will conclude with a couple of people who are signed up against this, Harry Jackson and Bernie Bottomley. And while they're coming up here, I will note for the record that we have signed up in favor, and we will not have time to hear our Harry Jackson, Excuse me, folks, I have a cold, and I'm not thinking as clearly as I like to most of the time. We have signed up Amy Alkanich, Steve Berman, and Andrea Meyer, who are all signed up in favor of this bill and won't get a chance. So welcome to the committee.
Am I first? Bernie Bottomley. I'm with the Portland Business Alliance. We represent about 1,300 businesses in the Portland area, and I've submitted written testimony, which I won't go over in detail. It seems to me that there's a couple of issues. One is I just want to let you know that our members, particularly those businesses in the downtown central city, have found this to be a very effective and important tool for them in creating a streetscape environment that's conducive to their businesses and to safe and secure and inviting streets. the downtown businesses in Portland feel so strongly about ensuring the security and safety of the streets there that they tax themselves to the tune of about $4 million a year. An amount of that money goes to pay for Portland police officers to patrol, provide additional patrols downtown, as well as our own security officers. But a fair proportion of that also goes to Central City Concern to assist with programs that help individuals who are homeless or those who have been in chronic situations with law enforcement to get out of those situations. So we provide jail-to-work assistance and housing assistance and other programs downtown. So I don't want to be the chamber to be viewed as only coming at this from the enforcement side. We understand that that there are a variety of issues at play here. We are also cognizant of the fact that although very effective, these exclusion zones may have the perception that they impact people of color more than they impact others, and we're very concerned about that. And we recognize that for this tool to be effective, it has to be fair, it has to be evenly applied, it has to be transparent, it has to be flexible in terms of being adjusted over time if there are legitimate concerns about how it's applied that are found. We believe that the appropriate venue for those discussions to happen is at the city, rather than have the legislature preempt this tool from even being considered at the local level. The data for the last 9 months has just been compiled. It has not been analyzed appropriately or thoroughly yet. We look forward to the city establishing and continuing the committee that is designed to look at those issues and to determine whether there are concerns about how this is applied. And we're ready to work with the city to make adjustments in how it's applied if those are found to be necessary based on the data. But we think it's premature to make a decision to eliminate this tool prior to that process going forward. There's one other issue that it seems to me that has been discussed by a number of people, and that's the due process issue and whether or not this is an appropriate process. And I'd just like to read a short citation from an Oregon appellate decision which related to exclusion zones. It had to do with double jeopardy, so it's not exactly on point. But what they found was that the ordinances demonstrate a concern for the quality of life in the designated zones in general and not a desire to seek retribution against individuals who commit crimes. The fact that excluded individuals may obtain variances to carry out legitimate business in designated zones supports our conclusion that although the ordinances are intended to deter drug crime, the overriding purpose is to achieve legitimate civil goals. And a number of folks have mentioned, why not apply this to prostitution-free zones? There are other actions that the courts and the city law enforcement take in civil actions that do not require a conviction. Forfeiture of an automobile or impoundment of an automobile in a drunk driving incident, closure of a building that is a chronic nuisance, all of these kinds of things, which are civil actions that the jurisdiction takes to protect the livability of the community, take place under probable cause rather than a conviction.
Bernie, I'm going to have to let you conclude here.
And we oppose the bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. That was easy. Okay, Mr. Jackson.
Okay, Senator Burbank and the others on the panel here. I'm Harry Jackson. I just retired from the City of Portland Police Bureau after 26 years, 30 years in law enforcement altogether. All of my 26 years was in the area that we're talking about here where they shifted from downtown to the Albina area. Most of that time was as a supervisor. And I can tell you the people that I supervised went out, and I believe, I really do believe, that they use this tool fairly. I don't support this bill. And for the people who do support this, I'm saying be careful what you ask for. I was there when they did the first drug detail. And I can tell you times have changed since we've had this tool, and it is a tool. People were sleeping in the bathtubs and in the basements because of bullets coming through their houses, because of people being shot. I know of one young man who was 17 years old who was shot 5 times. He recovered from that, and less than a year later he was shot 11 times and it killed him. I've had conversation with his mother. She would love to have had a drug-free zone and have him excluded because she could not control him. He kept coming back. Taking up what Richard Brown was from where he stopped, put a lot of time in there. And a lot of people who oppose to this don't understand it from the police and the victims, the true victims. That is the community. Took a lot of calls from the community at urging the police to do something about the drug dealing. They went as far as to say, my 7-year-old child can see this drug dealing out there. Why don't you do something? And according to the law, we just can't arrest people because someone say that. It takes a lot of time and resources. This bill makes it, Mr. Hayden's part of this makes it to where you don't have to go out and hide in the bushes to make an arrest for the chronic users and sellers that we have in the community. If they're there, it makes it real simple that all police, not just the specialty units, drug and vice, can take a part in ridding the community of chronic users and sellers. But it makes it where you get within 15 minutes, you can get that person off the street. And I've received a number of calls from the community. They're real happy that the police did something, not realizing that probably this person's not going to go to jail. They'll probably be back tomorrow, but they were real happy when their kids are being raised up in the area there. So I can tell you that this bill will take all that away. And as I said before, be careful what you ask for, because if you want people littering your streets like they were before, that's probably going to happen again, because all of the people that can't come in and stand on their favorite corner they've been standing on for years and years and years, they're going to come back. So I don't support this bill.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for coming. And I want to thank the ACLU for submitting written testimony and invite anyone who hasn't had a chance to testify to submit written testimony to the record, and we will consider it. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 642 and announce that we will refer the Senate, we will move the Senate bills that are on our agenda today to tomorrow's agenda, and we will reschedule the House bill, House Bill 2379, that we have on for public hearing. We will reschedule that for a later time. And with that, we are adjourned.
Okay. Here